Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. The Roman Empire is thought of as one of the most powerful empires in human history, with broad reach in Europe, Africa, and Asia Minor. But as we all know, the Roman Empire did indeed fall after several centuries of economic and political power. Many historians have tried to understand why exactly the Roman Empire fell, and many theories have emerged. In the present day, the United States and the West at large has been seen for several centuries as the world's superpower, similar in many ways to the power held by the Roman Empire. But with the current geopolitical landscape, it seems as if America may succumb to the same fate as Rome. So what is the phenomenon that is occurring here? Why do empires fall? And perhaps more importantly, why do we care if empires fall? I'm joined today by Peter Heather. Peter is a British historian of late antiquity in the early Middle Ages. He is the chair of the Medieval History Department and professor of medieval history at King's College London. He specializes in the fall of the Western Roman Empire and the Goths, on which he for decades has been considered the world's leading authority. He is the author of the book, Why Empires Fall: Rome, America, and the Future of the West. Peter, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here.
It's a really interesting topic. It's an apt topic in many ways, which is why you wrote the book, Why Empires Fall, Rome, America, and the Future of the West. I want to start off, for many of us who don't really know much about just the history of the fall of Rome, before we start comparing it to the potential fall of the West, which we'll dissect. In terms of the timeline, I know when I was younger and I heard about the fall of Rome, I thought, oh, this must have just been like a very quick event. But in reality, it took several centuries for the fall of Rome to occur. What is the brief history, so to speak, of how the Roman Empire was the global superpower and the timeline of when it diminished?
Yeah, I think the thing to understand is that it's an imperial system that evolves over time. So it's not one thing. When we talk about the fall of Rome, you know, you're thinking about the city and the political structures there. And obviously the empire is created by a military force that's generated around that city. Between 300 BC and the birth of Christ, those sort of three centuries, this superpower slowly creates itself, based on resources in central and southern Italy, and then spreads its domination, well, westwards into Spain and into North Africa, then eastwards into Egypt and Greece and what's now Turkey, and eventually north of the Alps as well, covering all of France and the Low Countries, more or less, in that period. But it evolves. I mean, it's an imperial system which has the capacity to co-opt the elites that it takes on board. So the sort of first thing I get my students to try and understand about the late empire is that the Roman Empire, by the time we get to the, say, 3rd century AD, so another 300 years beyond the moment of creation, it's not being run from the city of Rome. And actually, if you're asking who's a Roman at that point, it's a landowning elite that stretches from Hadrian's Wall to the Euphrates, all the way from Scotland to Iraq. They're all living in villas. They've all bought into Greco-Roman culture. They wear togas. They're looking to emperors as the keystones, cornerstones of their political, public lives. That is the way the imperial system evolves. So it incorporates all these people and it turns them into Romans. And that also then means when we're looking at the fall, we're looking at a system unraveling. And I think, to my mind, that's the best way to start thinking about it, because it immediately means you're not going to be monocausal. A system doesn't unravel for one reason. Various intersecting factors start to come into play with one another to then undermine the capacity of the system to keep going. And that, when we're looking at the western half of the empire, that's basically the 5th century AD that it unravels. And if you're looking at the eastern half of the empire, which survives the 5th century, it's the 7th century that it unravels. So the superpower imperial system lasts from, say, 100 BC to 600 AD, so 700 years. I mean, it's a huge amount of time.
Well, that's a very long time. And the way you explain it about looking at the system makes sense, because especially when it's such a vast empire that encompasses so, so much land and so many different cultures that then kind of come to embody the Roman Greco culture, there's obviously systems at play there. Now, the kind of primary work that assessed why Rome fell was Edward Gibbon's a few centuries ago. What was his general thesis about why the Roman Empire fell? And then I'm curious how you've addressed your own thesis and how that might differ, the more modern take as opposed to what was considered kind of the status quo that Edward Gibbons had proposed a few centuries ago.
Yeah, Gibbon had a couple of things going on. He's not monocausal. He's a smart guy who read everything. So in his perspective, there is a kind of internal collapse of the will to dominate. And he does link that to the rise of Christianity within the Roman world. As Christianity becomes a dominant force, it kind of loses its, or undermines the willingness of the Roman imperial elite to maintain itself by vigorous military, political, diplomatic action. So he's got that going on. And he does also think that outside invasion is important, that barbarians are important. We've got basically trajectories that are unfolding in Gibbon's narrative. What I think he's, in addition to that, it's worth picking out from him, is that he saw a long period of decline setting in from an apogee of the empire in something like the 2nd century, the Antonine Age, golden Antonine Age. And he sees, so that, as I said, the political unraveling of the western half of the empire is 300 years after that, in the 5th century. For Gibbon, there is a steady decline after the 2nd century, which then culminates in the empire's unwillingness or incapability to confront barbarians in the 5th century.
In terms of Christianity, on some levels that surprises me, because Christianity you could think of as a unifying force as that developed. But are you saying that while that might have been a unifying force, it was a different unifying force than the traditional Roman ideals that had been the initial cornerstone and pillar of Roman values that were part of the Roman Empire?
That's what Gibbon said. It's not what I...
Not what you're saying.
No, I think Christianity works very nicely within the Roman imperial system, and people forget about those rather embarrassing things that Jesus says about turning the other cheek. And it doesn't seem to inhibit the capacity of Roman armies to beat the crap out of people any more than it's inhibited any Christian states ever since from doing exactly the same thing. So I think Gibbon is a figure of the Enlightenment, and he's lightly poking fun at Christianity in that line of argument. I unfortunately never got to meet him, but I slightly wonder if he was actually slightly cracking a joke there.
You weren't around 300 years ago?
No, I mean, I am very old now, but not quite that old.
No, I'm just kidding. So let's get to your research then, because you are here and can explain your points of view. What is your general thought on why Rome fell? And when I say that, it might be important to preface first what it actually means when we say that Rome declined and that Rome fell. Are we talking about it in economic implications in terms of the land? What exactly was that fall? Was it the fact that the Roman Empire from Rome and then in the eastern aspect from Constantinople was no longer in charge of so many states abroad?
Yes, it fundamentally it's that, in the sense that in the 5th century what we see is the area of the Western Empire, which is sort of North Africa to Britain, so Italy and Spain and France and Belgium, etc., you know, in between. All of that comes no longer to be ruled from one central imperial court, but to be ruled from a series of royal courts founded. It's the basis of successor states. And the vast majority of these royal courts that have replaced the unitary rule from one imperial court are headed by a dynast, a dynasty, a king, a royal line that originated outside of Rome's frontiers within living memory. So kings of Goths, kings of Burgundians, very small-scale Anglo-Saxon kingships in Britain. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the end of a unitary political system across Western Eurasia, north and south of the Mediterranean. That's what it looks like. And that's what we're having to explain as to why that happens. There's one thing that we know now that Gibbon didn't know. And this is to my mind, this is the game changer. And it emerged from the capacity of archaeologists actually to measure rural productivity. The vast majority of the Roman Empire is an agricultural economy. What's happening in agriculture is what really matters. There's a bit of industry, a bit of craft manufacture, whatever, but the health of the agricultural economy is telling you about the economic health of the system. And what we now know is that the agricultural economy was at its busiest in the 4th century AD on the eve of the 5th century collapse. So what's really changed is the idea of this long, slow decline from the 2nd century onwards, which is fundamental to Gibbon's point of view. And it's simply not right. There are more people doing more things in the Roman countryside. That doesn't mean there aren't other problems, of course, but the sort of model that you had going until the last few decades of the 20th century was that political collapse came after a long period of slow economic decline. And that is not supportable any longer.
Because we know from that archaeological evidence, yes, that agriculture was actually booming up, yeah, until the end of the, yeah, 4th century.
Absolutely. Imperial GDP must be at its highest in the 4th century, not, you know, back in the Antonine period of the 2nd or whatever. I don't know of anyone who disputes that as a simple fact. So that's changed what we're trying to explain. Political collapse now is very sudden, and and the backdrop is of this economic expansion. What I've always worked on, what my fundamental interest in has been throughout my career, is the way in which living and interacting with big imperial societies like Rome, or in fact, Carolingian Empire later, I'm interested in all of these, affects the peoples around it. So the smaller groupings that live around the edge of big imperial systems, how does that interaction change them? And to my mind, one of the main things that is destabilizing the Roman imperial system and making it more difficult for it to continue to function as a unifying force across Western Europe is that over the long term, interaction with the Roman Empire changes the people around it. It generates an economic revolution. It generates economic expansion. It generates political reorganization. Basically, the functioning of the imperial system creates enemies come partners who are more difficult for the empire to manage. So, as it were, you're changing the strategic context within which the empire is functioning. There are other things I'd bring in too, but as it were, the driving force behind my own research and my own line of thinking has been that to concentrate on the internal history of the empire is fine, but you need also to bring into the picture the fact that the 500-year existing empire changes the strategic context in which it's operating and actually makes it more difficult for itself to continue to function.
So is the crux of that come down to that it became too big to maintain a sense of cohesion, or more that it was in existence for so long that it was bound to unravel because that kind of context had changed, and thus the systems that were initially put in place were no longer appropriate for the new context?
I think both things are true, but I think the second point is the most destabilizing point, in the sense that you find next to the empire in the 4th and 5th centuries, much larger, as the Romans would call them, barbarian confederations than had existed in the 1st and 2nd century. They're politically more complex. They combine lots more people. They're better armed. They're better organized. They're much more difficult to dominate. And Rome is operating with a series of partners by the time we get to the 4th century in a way that simply wasn't true in the 1st and 2nd centuries. I wouldn't discount the first point either, because actually, when we're looking at the internal politics and cohesion of the empire, turning all these landowning elites from Britain to Iraq into Romans actually massively complicates the political process. Because in the 1st century, when the empire has been created, you only have to satisfy Roman senatorial elites in and around central and southern Italy, who are all focused on the Senate of Rome. You know, that's, as an emperor, that's your internal political problem. Keep a critical mass of those people happy, and the world is fine. By the time we get to the 4th century, we've got people who regard themselves as Roman all the way from Britain to Iraq, and they all want their share of the redistributory.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mechanisms of the empire, all the goodies that come from the empire existing. So you have a lot of contending voices. And so I do think the internal political balancing act is made more complex by the very success of the empire. The whole world is full of these blasted Romans, and they all think they should have a right to, you know, a reasonable share of the emperor's attention and the emperor's favor and all the rest of it. And that does make it more difficult. But I think, you know, the empire had been the same size for half a millennium, 500 years, you know, it's such a long time. There is no state, I mean, apart from China, there is no state that lasts that long in the entire, certainly in Western Eurasian history. There's nothing that big that lasts that long. So, you know, it's not that it becomes too big to falls apart, because it's that big for so long. It is, I think, the changing of the strategic context as these much bigger powers are created around its fringes that starts to pull it apart.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So let's pivot to a big emphasis of your book and the thesis of the book, which is relating the fall of Rome to the decline of the United States and the West, so to speak. In some ways, it's a different situation now in that it's not such an imperial force. Now, it used to be more of an imperial force, where the West controlled foreign lands and governed there. That's not the case anymore. But when you're referring to the decline of the United States, what's the important thing to distinguish between the two? And then we'll come to some of the commonalities.
Yes, I think what is clearly different is that when the sort of foreign policy threat starts to build up in the Roman Empire, there isn't any obvious way to expand economic resources and demographic resources. You know, this is a pretty steady state agricultural economy. You can't suddenly invent tractors, and we don't have artificial fertilizer. We're not going to dramatically change the basic resource capacity of the Roman imperial system. So as it comes under stress and under threat, it reacts by expanding. And there's also the case that it is dominating some of the best real estate in Western Eurasia. So if you come to a competition for resources, outside eyes will tend to move into Roman territory, because you can see it's wealthier, it's more developed. So predatory eyes are thinking they'd quite like a piece of that action. And those, I think, are the two things that I see as very different, in the sense that obviously the sort of staggering growth rates of the 50s, 60s, and to some extent the 70s have slowed down and are probably not going to return. But Western economies are still growing and probably will continue to grow. And the other thing is that the sort of foreign policy threat is not really taking any kind of form of wanting to predate on and actually annex territories that belong to America and its allies, to its Western European allies. So, and that I think is reflecting the fundamental difference in economic circumstances.
When we start to look at this idea of the decline of the United States, of America, of the West, what are we measuring that by? What are the metrics that suggest decline, if you think we're already in that decline? Or what will that look like if we're forecasting a decline? Are we talking about political influence around the world? Are we talking about economics, which might be the cornerstone that then leads to political influence?
I think we're talking about relative decline. In other words, in that sort of post-World War II heyday, the Western world's dominance of the global economy was absolutely staggering. On the eve of the financial crash of 2000, and then 80% of world GDP is generated or consumed in the West, in America and its allies. So four-fifths. That's a staggering amount.
Wow.
And this is what we're talking about. You know, some Americans, some Europeans have got poorer since then, but the economies haven't shrunk. What has happened is that a whole series of other economies around the world are exploding. So the Western share of GDP is 60% and declining gently, not because Western economies are shrinking. They're not growing very much, but they are still growing a bit, but because the rest of the world is expanding economically. So this is, I think, what decline looks like. It's not an absolute loss of wealth in the first instance, but it's a relative shrinking of the percentage of world GDP that's generated and dominated in the West, which must have then knock-on effects on political diplomatic influence across the globe. There might be further economic consequences for that, but it's not fundamentally the point that Western economies are declining. It's the fact that economies elsewhere are expanding so dramatically.
You do speak in your book and just in some of your works about some of the internal factors as well, not just how the external factors of other countries doing really well in addition to the West has led to this idea of the decline of the West. One of the things you talk about is immigration. Talk to me about that and how you feel, if so, that is related to this idea of the potential decline.
Yeah, I take a very particular view on immigration, and that is closely linked to an understanding of demography in the West. The crucial thing is that every adult woman has to have 2.1 children for a population to reproduce itself. And across the vast majority of the Western developed world, and it's Iceland and Israel are the only two exceptions, that is not the case. The adult females in our populations in general are not having anywhere near 2.1 children. This is being hidden by a related fact, which is that longevity is increasing dramatically. and has been increasing dramatically since 1945. I mean, a 63-year-old British male, my grandfather at this age, just after 1945, had a life expectancy of about another 5 years. Mine, thank goodness, touch wood, spit, whatever.
I'll knock on some wood for you too.
We can talk averages here without, I think, chancing our arm in terms of hubris. You know, it's considerably more than that. It's about 17 years more than that, in fact. So gone from mid-60s to mid-80s is the average. And it's the same elsewhere. So populations haven't shrunk yet, but they've aged. And what this means is that the dependency ratios in Western societies, those not working to those working, have increased dramatically. And immigration has to be understood, in my view, as part of that. You know, immigration is about the only way to fill in the gaps in the labor supply that the low reproductive rates of native populations, and combined with aging, that's a really big demographic effect in Western societies. And it's created a problem. We don't have enough people. And actually, so therefore, I don't really share the furore about immigration as a straightforward kind of, you know, I did spend a bit of time in the British Treasury. They half trained me as an economist before I went back into history. You know, I don't, where else are you going to fill in the gaps in the labor force from? People aren't suddenly going to have loads more children. That is not a future that, you know, they've tried to make that happen in places like Hungary, and they've moved it up an absolute fraction. But they had a big conference celebrating it last year, but actually they've moved it up from 1.4 to 1.6 as the average, with a huge amount of economic blandishment towards having more children. It's still nowhere near the 2.1 that you need for the Hungarian population to reproduce itself. So, you know, the idea that by doing this, you will obviate the need for immigration is nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. You're still going to end up with a smaller, older population and not enough people working to support all the people who aren't working because they're passed into retirement.
So if you contend that immigration is necessary, then, in order to maintain the population and the working population, are you also contending that such immigration would then lead to decline in some sense of the West in terms of its culture? And I know it's a controversial thing to talk about, but that some people would say that's anti-multicultural, but I think it's a fair thing to just ask the question, because we're not necessarily saying that that's even a bad thing if it's a decline of the West as we know it. But is the idea that as immigration becomes more necessary, that that will in some ways lead to a decline of the West as we know it?
I would say I would be much happier with the word transformation, I think.
That's a much better word.
I wouldn't for a moment want to underestimate the challenges involved here. I mean, this is, you know, my father's generation grew up in the 1920s. George V was on the throne. He was still emperor of India. You know, being white and European or North American was the kind of, you know, the be all and the end all. And, you know, that world will take a long time to adjust to the idea that actually, okay, everybody's human and we all are more or less equal shares and we all have a right to a voice. And there's a lot of cultural complexity to be negotiated in that. And that, I don't underestimate the difficulties of that for a moment. I mean, I really don't. But it's going to be unavoidable, I think. And, you know, you might want not to have to do it. And it will be problematic at points. I have not the slightest doubt about, but it does seem to me unavoidable. And we're not just talking about skilled immigration either. We had this thing during the COVID lockdowns in Britain where every Thursday night everybody had to go out and clap essential workers. It was a kind of ritualistic act. But if you looked at who the essential workers are, there are all kinds of people who aren't highly skilled, but are absolutely necessary to the functioning of your economy, people who care for others, people who load lorries and move stuff, food around in warehouses, you know, not mass, you know, not doctors or neuroscientists or whatever, but they're absolutely critical. You know, unskilled labor is just as critical as skilled labor to the functioning of an economy. And you will need all these people. And we will need all these people. Otherwise, I think the dependency ratios in the West will become catastrophic, in fact. And you can see that pressure building up a bit, I think.
Immigration's obviously right now a very hot issue in the States as they're trying to secure their border in the South. And it's also been a big trend in Europe with a lot of refugee crises over the last while. Do you view that as a bad thing, or do you view that as, no, that is just a transformation, which is normal and necessary, and that if that does lead to a change in the West or a similar fall? And when I say fall and decline, I don't mean that in a negative way, but the same way that Rome changed and was no longer the Roman Empire. If this immigration, which we view is as necessary for the labor force, if that does continue and that does change the demography of these countries, and ultimately there is a quote unquote fall of the West in the sense that we knew it, or a transformation, I guess my question ultimately comes down to, is that a bad thing? Or is that just a trend that we're observing, which is natural, the same way the Roman Empire no longer existed in its form, the West will no longer exist in that form? Or is there the concern that with the transformation, some of the important values that have been established in the West might fall with it? And is that where the concern lies?
I do think you're right to talk about the key values, because I don't have any kind of hankering after the British Empire. I don't want it to return, I hasten to add. But I teach, I'm a university teacher. I teach people from all over the world. London is an incredibly cosmopolitan city. And teaching students from all over the place, you become very conscious of what it is about Western society that makes it actually a nice place to live compared to many other places in the world. And it's not voting. Everybody votes everywhere, you know. It's actually things like the rule of law and a reasonably balanced press to hold power to account. These are the key values that I would identify within Western societies. But loads of people want to participate in that. You know, a friend of mine who taught in Azerbaijan sent a few students in my direction, and I was talking to one of them, and she said, I can't believe how relaxed all British people are. And we're relaxed because you can't just be screwed over because the person next door has a connection in the party and can therefore take something from you that they want, just like that. You know, the legal systems obviously are slightly skewed towards those with money or whatever, but they are a block on power, on the kind of, you know, straightforward transmission of wealth becoming the right to do whatever you bloody well want to do, you know, and that's really important. And those are the kind of values that became hardwired into Western society. I mean, proper democracy, not just voting, but the rule of law and balanced parties and a broad presentation of news reporting, all of these kinds of things, the deeper structures, they do actually make for not a perfect society. A perfect society has never existed and never will, but it's certainly a better one. And there are plenty of us out there in the world who would be very happy to participate in those kind of structures. And I know that John, who I wrote the book with, thinks the same way, that this is the kind of transformation of the West that could potentially be very positive, not a kind of throwing up of restrictive boundaries around some kind of biological sense of Westernness, but a real identification of what are the Western cultural values that actually make life better for most people within Western societies, and a willingness to embrace other people who would like to be part of that. I mean, there are a lot of countries, India and South America, who have long histories of association with the West and would be, I think, probably opened kind of very positive dialogue in that direction.
So my impression of what you're saying is that some people would view that transformation as scary because it could potentially change the values, and that's a lot of the concern of immigration. But on the other hand, you're saying a lot of people probably do have those same Western values, which is a good thing, because as they come in, we can kind of adapt and just allow people to have those freedoms that they seek.
I'll just add one thing and then hand back to you. I think that you can also expand your concept of Westernness to include a whole slew of societies in the developing world who would be open to alliance building, not as a kind of colonial domination or post-colonial domination, which is what we've seen so far, but, you know, a much more an association of equals. Yeah.
As I said, it's a controversial topic, and you're an extremely well-renowned historian, the expert in your field. You've faced a bit of, I don't want to say criticism, but other experts have, you mentioned the word biological there, have said that you're having a biological approach to Westernness, which I think you just explained there as not really a biological approach. Do you find it's a tough topic for you to talk about often in this world we live in now, to talk about these issues and to say, yeah, I am not anti-immigration, but I do have a concern about Western values? Some people say that's not a fair concern. That is anti-immigration, that is anti-multiculturalism. That's not what I'm hearing from you, because I think it's a lot more nuanced than that. How do you respond to people who are uncomfortable with this conversation and say that any concern about immigration and multiculturalism is a negative, as opposed to looking at it and saying, well, I'm not necessarily saying immigration is a bad thing, but at the same time, I'm not just going to scoff at Western values as a negative thing, because Western values is a good ideal that's taken many, many years to develop.
Yeah, some of them are good. I mean,
some of them are good. And I don't want to downplay that, because some of them are not. Western, I'm being that's naive. Serious. Western history is also rooted in slavery. It's also rooted in racism.
Absolutely,
I do not want to deny that at all. So some people would make a natural link and say that anti-immigration or being concerned about immigration is just furthering racist tendencies. How do you balance that when approaching this topic? And how should other people balance that when looking at this topic?
I think everybody has to find their own path through it. And I wouldn't begin to dictate up. I mean, I'm very positive and pro-immigration. I don't have any concerns about it. You know, it will be problematic, but, you know, life is problematic. Human beings, we're competitive. Evolution has generated us. You know, we're capable of cooperation, yet we're also the most vicious predator that evolution has ever thrown up. And we predate on each other as well as on other species. You know, you can't pretend human beings are other than what they are. That doesn't make any sense. You've got to go from where we are. So, you know, I'm not expecting things to be easy or straightforward or whatever. But as a historian and as a person living in my society partway into the 21st century, I absolutely see migration as totally inevitable. And this does not mean it will be easy. It does not mean it will be straightforward. But the alternative is far worse. It will be these really difficult dependency ratios as the labor force shrinks, and it will create far more problems not to have migration than it will to have it. So we've all got to get together and work out the best way forward. It will not be plain sailing. I wouldn't expect it to be, but that's what's going to happen. The other thing to notice, and I think is worth bringing in, is that I think this is probably a pretty temporary phase, in the sense that the birth rates are going down in the developing world dramatically. I mean, the European empires were created at a moment when, thanks to the wonders of inoculation and more available food, children survived in extraordinary numbers in European societies. As late as the 1830s, 50% of all children didn't make it to adulthood in Germany, would you believe? I mean, that is the thing that most startled me when we started looking at the demographic patterns. And the European population as a percentage of the global population is usually 12, 13, 14%, something like that. In 1900, it's 25%, because all of these children have survived. And it was realizing that all your children were going to survive that then brought down birth rates. And we're now back down at the normal ratio of Europeans to the rest of the globe, you know, somewhere around 15% or thereabouts. But that demographic transition, the second demographic transition, which is when people start having less children because their children are surviving and because they're a bit wealthier, that is already unfolding in the developing world. And the smart money suggests that within 20 years, Western countries will be queuing up for migrants, actually, because they will not be available in massive numbers because they will not need to leave home, and the populations will be falling in relative terms in the rest of the planet. Well, except, of course, if there's massive climate emergencies, that might stop people moving on a staggering scale, but we're not talking about that issue today. That's a separate one. But this is a particular moment, this current moment of migration. And in some ways, I think people shouldn't be getting too kind of worried about it. They need to take a slightly longer term view.
Mm-hmm. And some people, and then there's the element of even when those conditions change, some people might still, many people will presumably still want to migrate, even if the West is not as reliant on migrants for their labor force. And that's a different, somewhat intertwined debate as to what that should be. And that it's all very challenging, as you say. And I think to look at the immigration standpoint without nuance is easy, but it's very complex, regardless how you look at it and regardless where you stand on the issue.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that's going on is that you've got, and this is, you know, coming back to the vision of why Western global domination simply cannot be exercised to the same degree now as it was in the 60s and 70s, or even the 80s and 90s. You've got very large scale economic expansion in lots of other parts of the planet. You know, China, BRIC countries, India always get talked about, but they're kind of yesterday's news. 7 out of the 10 fastest growing economies are now African. So, you know, this story is not yet over. And of course, as economies expand elsewhere, the attractiveness of the West, relative attractiveness of the West, will decline too. You know, especially, you know, the West is a long way away and it's quite difficult to force your way in and so on. So, you know, where I do honestly think we're at a very particular moment in the kind of global migration cycle, and that some of the big parameters are in the process that generating it the way that it is at the moment are in the process of changing. And we will see it change. Well, certainly within your lifetime, maybe not within mine. It depends how longevity goes in the UK.
So, Peter, before we end, I just want to zoom back out a little bit. So your book is called Why Empires Fall, Rome, America, and the Future of the West. And we've dissected that. Ultimately, some people, when they read the title of that, might say, okay, I am concerned why empires fall. We don't want the West to fall like Rome fell. Is that what you're saying, or are you saying ultimately we need to be okay with this transformation? This isn't something we should be scared of. The main thing we need to make sure we preserve is some of those core ideals as that happened, but a transformation is inevitable, and you're not advocating we need to prevent this from happening.
It is, as you were saying, to my mind, the transformation is inevitable. The sort of Western domination of global GDP is over, and it can only continue heading in the direction of other places becoming equally wealthy. And it isn't that the West is becoming less wealthy, so other places are becoming equally wealthy, and that is changing global strategic context in some very dramatic ways. That is absolutely inevitable. What's not inevitable is how we react to it. Yeah.
And that isn't necessarily a bad thing, that GDP is being spread. That in many ways sounds like a good thing.
I do think that. And, you know, if we embrace it, if we don't kind of lament the fact that we can't go in and change other people's political systems overnight by sending a gunboat, as the British wanted to do in the 19th century or whatever, and accept that, then there's everyone being wealthier could offer the basis for a much more stable future, where, because, you know, again, taking a long view, the big issues are really global warming and pollution, and we need everybody on board for that, because you can't do that by yourself. Doesn't matter what size economy you are, that is a global problem, and that requires global solutions. And to generate any kind of cooperative, more or less total response to that kind of problem, the scale of it requires that kind of global cooperation. Well, you know, then the basis of that will have to be a much more equal share of world wealth and less of a sense of resentment in the places that have been cut out of the share in the wealth in the 20th century. So, yeah, no, I mean, you can cut it in a much more optimistic way, I think. The end of basically North America and Europe dominating the planet doesn't have to be a bad thing.
Could be a very good thing.
Yeah, it could. Really could.
Peter, Heather, thank you so much for joining me. Really, really interesting conversation. You can find Peter's book, Why Empires Fall, Rome, America, and the Future of the West, on Amazon, or just type in Peter Heather's name and you'll find all his other books. Thank you so much for joining me on Preconceived.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.